Welcome to Royally Screwed. My name is Chris Shearer, and it's my honor to take you on a tour through some of history's greatest, worst, and bizarre rulers. Well, everyone, this is it. The final episode of the Julio-Claudian saga. I started this story way back in episode 5, and I'm glad that I've finally been able to actually make it all the way to the end. It's been a long road of triumph, defeat, betrayal, and just overall craziness. We've seen the rise of Julius Caesar as dictator for life, and we've seen Tiberius descend into a state of paranoia where he left behind his empire to the hands of a sadist. And more recently, we've covered the reign of Nero Claudius Caesar Augustus Germanicus, a young man only 16 years old when he was named emperor, who should have been able to live a different life. A man who loved the arts much more than he loved being a ruler, which is really bad for the people when you rule one of the largest nations in the world at the time. Nero the musician, Nero the wife killer. Nero, perhaps not as completely complicated as Gaius Germanicus, aka Caligula, but still a man with many facets. Many of those facets, unfortunately, terrible. Nero was the fifth and final emperor of the Julio-Claudian dynasty. He only lived to be 30 years old, which, fun fact, is the age I currently am. We've covered more or less the first 29 years of his life. His rule alongside his mother Agrippina, his bizarre lifestyle that even caused controversies at the Olympic Games, the Great Fire of Rome that I still believe Nero absolutely did not start but fully took advantage of. How does a man like this meet his end? Obviously, in hindsight, it's very easy to see why people of Rome would hate him. But Nero had ruled for about 14 years before any action was taken to see him taken out. Who ultimately ended the imperial line that had lasted over a century? Well, let's find out, shall we? So without further ado, let's end the saga. We're going back in time to the Roman Empire in 68 CE in Sic Semper Tyrannis. Our story begins not in Rome, not even in Italy. Our story begins in Gaul. As I went over in the previous Nero episode, the Great Fire of Rome in 64 CE had forced Nero to raise countless taxes so he could rebuild the capital city of the empire bigger and better, especially more fireproof too. Unfortunately, this meant that Nero had to levy massive taxes against the other provinces, especially those further out from Rome, such as the provinces that made up Gaul. Even several years later in 68 CE, the taxes were being levied and raised. Things finally reached a breaking point when Julius Vindex, the governor of Gallia Lugdunensis, which made up central Gaul, aka northern France, decided to revolt against the emperor. He sent letters to the other provincial governors demanding that they join him against the powers of Nero to overthrow the leader of Rome. As far as we know, at least from historian Plutarch, several other governors sent Vindex's letters to Nero himself. The governor of Roman Spain, Servius Sulpicius Galba, kept the letter to himself but was unsure of how to move forward with the information, not wishing to outright rebel against Nero. After meeting with some of his advisors, Galba decided that maybe it was a good idea after all to fight against Nero. After all, the western provinces certainly had the soldiers to lead an armed rebellion against the emperor's personal guard. Nero was also fairly unpopular, so it was likely that there wouldn't be too much aid from the other provinces further east. So, readying his soldiers in Spain, Galba also called for open rebellion against the emperor. Vindex then called for Galba to declare himself the new emperor of Rome. Why Vindex didn't want to be emperor, I do not know. Galba himself was also hesitant about taking on such a duty. While his soldiers hailed him as the new Caesar, Galba very much preferred to be titled General of the Roman Senate and People. Now, you may be wondering how Nero was actually feeling about this open rebellion against his rule. And the answer? He wasn't considering it that big of a deal, at least at first. According to Suetonius, who is the main source of a lot of this, so technically who knows how true it all is, sometime before the rebellion, Nero had visited the Oracle of Delphi, the most important prophet of the Greek and Roman world. The oracle had told him to beware the 70th year. Nero assumed this meant he would live to be 70 years old. So no matter what, he had several decades left to live. Apparently, if things ever went wrong in his life, he would simply brush it off because he thought things would turn around. Unfortunately for Nero, in early to mid 68 CE, Galba happened to be 70 years old. When Nero first heard about Vindex's rebellion, he was chilling in Naples with some of his entourage. It wasn't until he got news of Galba joining in that Nero started worrying. After all, Galba had been loyal to him for years. Then Vindex started releasing public speeches calling out Nero. The emperor was especially affected when Vindex called out his lyre playing as atrocious, a skill Nero particularly prided himself in, and called him a Henobarbus, Nero's cognomen at birth. I wasn't expecting dead naming to come up in a story about the Roman emperors, but I guess anything can happen at this point. Nero called for Virginius Rufus, the governor of Germania Superior, which occupied land in western Switzerland and southern Germany, to put down Vindex's army. When the two governors met on the 28th of July 68 CE, it was Virginius who came out on top. After the defeat, Vindex committed suicide. Unfortunately for the German governor, this caused his troops to start hailing Virginius himself as a new candidate for emperor. But with Vindex put down by orders from tyrant Nero, calls continued to be raised that Galba should be the new emperor. This led Nero to call upon the Senate, demanding they name the Spanish governor a public enemy. After doing this, Nero was also said to have sold off all of Galba's possessions in Rome. Not to be outdone, Galba had all of Nero's possessions in Spain put to auction. Rome was falling apart. Nero's end was finally in sight. Despite the large open rebellion against him, Nero apparently decided he would kinda just live as he normally did. He still threw massive parties and performed musical acts. Whenever news of a setback within the revolts came his way, Nero would write up a new song and have it performed, apparently accompanying these songs with gaudy shows and obscene gestures. So also add diss tracks to this story. But as the fighting continued on, the stress of it all went to Nero's head. He started to develop plans to completely destroy Rome. What good would that actually do? I don't know, but Nero now trusted no one but himself. He made plans to have all of the provincial governors and military leaders assassinated, as he no longer trusted them to be on his side. Obviously, all of the men of Gallic descent in Rome would also have to be put to death because they were clearly spies. The Senate would be poisoned and the city would be set on fire. Again. Also, for good measure, the people would be set up for death when Nero let loose every large wild animal that was held in the city during the frenzy. Obviously, none of these plans would actually come to pass. So instead, Nero decided to come up with another plan. He would personally lead an army into the western provinces, start crying, and beg the rebels to stop. That is genuinely what Suetonius says in his writings. Obviously, the rebels would stop what they were doing when they saw their emperor in tears and put down their weapons. From there, everyone could rejoice with festivities while listening to victory songs Nero would write himself. Absolutely solid plan, Mr. Emperor. I see no holes in it whatsoever. In order to get these plans rolling, Nero fired the two consuls that were ruling in 68 CE. For the first time in 8 years, Nero named himself as a consul of Rome, and also, from what I could tell, the only time he held the position by himself. Nero believed only a consul could hold the power to stop a rebellion, and he obviously had the greatest plan on how to do it. Unfortunately, this master plan required funding, and Nero actually needed to raise an army. You know, because the actual army was against him. Well, Nero decided that part of his army would be made up of his imperial concubines, who he demanded cut their hair short and dress up like Amazonian warriors. But a small group of Amazonian warriors, fake ones at that, does not make up an army, so the emperor turned to the people of Rome, asking them to join his grand army to reclaim the empire. And no one joined. Nero then demanded that everyone who owned slaves, regardless of social status, give some of their slaves to his army, with the emperor picking and choosing those he thought best suited to the task. Finally, Nero demanded all citizens of Rome to pay part of their income to the treasury. On top of that, anyone renting property had to immediately pay an amount equal to a year's worth of their rent. Unsurprisingly, considering the whole rebellion stemmed from taxes in the first place, very few people paid up. With seemingly no one at his side besides his servants, Nero decided to pivot. Maybe he wouldn't try to put down the rebels. Maybe he would just run away. Unfortunately for Nero, around this time, one of the prefects of the Praetorian Guard, Gaius Nymphidius Sabinus, had managed to amass control of his fellow guards and was looking to throw his support behind Galba. This meant that the emperor's own bodyguards were no longer supporting him. Nymphidius would actually try to proclaim himself emperor by saying he was the illegitimate son of Emperor Gaius Germanicus, insisting the emperor had been having an affair with his mother before Gaius became emperor. This plot never became anything during Nero's life, and Nymphidius would have to deal with that later. But back to Nero. The emperor was trying to decide what exactly he would do. He had to get out of Rome, but where would he go? Obviously, any further west was out of the question, not that Nero was particularly interested in that direction to begin with. The obvious choice would be somewhere outside of Europe. Egypt would be his best bet, but what if they didn't accept him? The long shot choice was ditching the empire altogether and begging the Parthian Empire, Rome's eastern neighbor in the Middle East, to give him safety. Heck, if all hope was truly lost, maybe Nero could actually just give up, throw himself at the feet of Galba, and beg to be kept alive. With that plan, maybe Nero could just go on to be a private citizen. So, with some sort of plan in mind, Nero snuck out of the palace and made his way to the port city of Ostia, where he hoped he could get some members of the Praetorian Guard to sail him to safety. However, when Nero begged the guards for help, they refused him. According to Suetonius, one guard even quoted the Aeneid, the Roman spin-off of the Iliad, to the emperor, saying, "Is it indeed so terrible to die?" Now, that story is probably made up by Suetonius, but dang, is that a great line to say to a tyrant fleeing from death. So, with absolutely no one willing to help him, Nero simply just returned to his palace in Rome. Apparently, Nero then wrote a speech that he wanted to give to the people, explaining his thought process of abandoning his duties, but he hid it away in fear that he would be killed before he was even able to get a word in. This speech was allegedly found after Nero's death. Some unspecified amount of time later, Nero woke up in the middle of the night to find out that all of the palace guards had left their posts, and many of his servants had also jumped ship in the middle of the night. This truly freaked out the emperor, and it caused him to go into a suicidal spiral. He cried out for his personal gladiator, who I guess for some reason lived with him, knowing Nero they were probably sleeping with each other, so that this guy could run him through with a sword. Unfortunately, Nero really was alone. Around this same time, the Senate convened to vote on what to do about the state of the empire. Clearly, Nero had gone off the deep end. Nobody wanted this guy around. He did more harm than good, as his very presence was now tearing the empire apart. So, with the power invested in them, the Senate declared Nero a public enemy and called for his arrest and execution. Now, the Senate vote was done without Nero knowing about it, so he's looking to kill himself while the rest of the government is also readying the chopping block. You'd think this would be a win-win situation, right? Rome gets rid of its problematic leader, and Nero gets to be untethered from his anxiety-ridden mortal coil. Well, that wasn't really how things lined up. So let's find out how Nero finally met his end. And to preface, this is all according to Suetonius, and I'll go into why that's not the best use of historical sources in a moment. Nero was desperate to find somewhere to die on his own terms. Apparently, he found such a place in the home of a former servant and friend, a man named Phaon. Accompanied by a couple other companions, including his husband Sporus, Nero left the palace in disguise, aka just wearing a cloak. Suetonius wrote that there was a storm overhead during the secret flight to Phaon's house. At one point, while passing a crowd of people, lightning flashed, briefly revealing Nero's face. A man who had been a former soldier recognized the emperor and saluted him. There were also groups of soldiers out that night looking for the emperor, so all of this made Nero even more paranoid. When they finally arrived at Phaon's property, Nero's friend said that he had dug a sand pit for the emperor to hide in until this all blew over. Nero refused to get in, saying he did not want to be in the earth while he still lived. He also refused to go through the front door, demanding that Phaon create a secret passage for him to enter through. Once this had been done, Nero crawled into the home and rested for a while. When his companions tried to get him to eat, Nero refused all offers except for water. During this time, everyone begged the emperor to come to his senses and change his mind about dying. In response to this, Nero got up and demanded that the others dig a grave that would be the proper size for his body. They were also to go fetch water and wood. The water was to wash his body after death, and the wood was to cremate his corpse. So why he needed a grave? I don't know. As he watched them perform the orders given, Nero apparently cried out, "What an artist the world is losing!" And I think that line is a bit heartbreaking. Here's a guy who clearly never wanted to be emperor and just wanted to be a famous musician. Like, I know he's actually an awful man who called for the deaths of thousands, but still. During all of this, a courier arrived with a letter for Phaon. The letter, which Nero also read, was the announcement that the Senate had decreed the emperor an enemy of the people and had called for his death. The mode of death was to be tied to two wooden beams in the shape of a V and then be beaten to death. Nero refused to die in this way and asked his friends to grab two daggers. With a sharpened dagger in hand, Nero hesitated. In the end, Nero was scared of death. In order to help him calm his nerves, Nero begged for someone else to stab themselves so that he could learn the best way to commit suicide. Before anyone could follow the emperor's orders, if they were actually going to do so at all, the group heard the sound of soldiers approaching Phaon's estate. Panicking, Nero attempted to stab himself in the throat but couldn't muster the strength. He asked one of his servants, a man named Epaphroditus, to help him push in the blade. Epaphroditus obeyed the command. When the soldiers finally made it into Phaon's home, Nero was already laying on the ground bleeding out. When one of them attempted to staunch the bleeding with a towel, Nero simply said, "Too late." So, on the 9th of June, 68 CE, at the age of 30 years old, Nero Claudius Caesar Augustus Germanicus, the fifth and final emperor of the Julio-Claudian dynasty, died. Now, what I just told you was the death of Nero as written by Suetonius in his multi-volume Lives of the 12 Caesars. Suetonius was born in 69 CE, the year following Nero's death. This obviously means he had to use resources available to him during his own lifetime detailing the lives of the Julio-Claudians. But we don't have those resources, so we have to take Suetonius's word as a possible truth. However, we also know that Suetonius was very biased against the emperors, believing more in the power of the Senate. The excruciating detail into which he writes about Nero's final few hours is either somehow copied from a work by someone who was at the emperor's side when he died, or, more likely, Suetonius created his own narrative. Tacitus, the other major Roman historian who would have actually been alive during Nero's death, wrote a whole book about the last Julio-Claudian, but the part that talks about Nero's last few years has since been lost. Cassius Dio, who was born a century after Nero's demise, wrote briefly about the emperor's death. He echoes some of what Suetonius wrote, but with a couple vague details changed. Plutarch, who also wrote about Nero, but say it with me, that work has been lost to time. In a biography he wrote about Galba, he simply says that Nero died, and that's it. All of this is to say, we don't actually know how Nero died. Did he take his own life? Was he killed by someone he trusted? Did the guards actually get to him in the end but struck him down before bringing him to the Senate? We don't know. Because of the mystery behind Nero's death, within the time period no less, it led many people coming up with conspiracies. Many people in Rome actually mourned for Nero's death. He actually had a large number of supporters outside of the Senate and military, and some refused to believe he had actually been killed. He wasn't even given a funeral that had become normal for the previous emperors, one that was a massive celebration of the emperor's life. No, Nero was simply cremated and interred in the mausoleum of his father's family, so not even in the mausoleum of Augustus with the other emperors. So, one of the biggest conspiracies was that Nero would one day return to Rome. Overall, this is called the Nero Redivivus legend. Some people believed he had died but would be resurrected and either save or destroy Rome on his return. Others believed he had managed to escape the hangman's noose and had fled to the safety of the Parthian Empire. Christian scholar Saint Augustine of Hippo, who lived in the 5th century, wrote that some people believed Nero was even still alive then, having somehow kept himself alive and still with the body and strength of a 30-year-old. This version of the legend would eventually morph into early Christians believing Nero was actually the Antichrist, given that he also had largely persecuted the Christians of Rome following the Great Fire. Others would take advantage of the uncertainty. Within a few months of Nero's death, either in late 68 CE or early 69 CE, a man in Greece proclaimed that he was actually Nero, alive and well. This fake Nero managed to get a group of deserters from the Roman army to join him, and they quickly became pirates around the Greek island of Kynthos. Nero's successor, who will remain nameless for now, ordered one of his newly selected provincial governors, Calpurnius Esperenus, to take care of the faker on his way out east to Asia Minor, aka Western Turkey. Esperenus and his soldiers quickly managed to take down the false Nero, beheaded him, and then paraded the head around Roman Asia. Around a decade later, so about 80 CE, it's just said to have been during the reign of Emperor Titus, who ruled from 79 to 81, a second imposter came forward and called himself Emperor Nero. This time, we actually have a name for the guy, Terentius Maximus, a Roman from the eastern provinces in Asia. There is very little about how convincing the first fake Nero was, but according to Cassius Dio, this Maximus guy had a lot going for him. Apparently he looked like Nero, I'm assuming a slightly older Nero for this to work, and also played the lyre. He managed to gain a solid number of followers who he led out of Rome into Parthia. He was greeted by the then king of the Parthians, Artabanus III, who desired to use Maximus to weaken Rome by putting the fake Nero on the throne as emperor. Unfortunately for Maximus, when Artabanus found out that he wasn't really Nero, the Parthians had the faker executed. Around a decade after Terentius Maximus played his games, a third man attempted to sway the masses by posing as Nero. We don't have much information about him, and all we really know is that he also went to the Parthians to get support. When Rome asked for this man claiming to be Nero to be returned to the empire, the Parthians refused. The matter almost resulted in the two imperial powers coming to blows, but that doesn't seem to have happened. He was also presumably killed sometime later, or at the very least, never gained any further power. I personally think it's really fun that I get to end the Julio-Claudian saga in the same way I began this podcast. Episode 1 was all about three different guys claiming to be the son of Ivan the Terrible, and now we have three men claiming to be Nero. Granted, the false Dimitris were much more successful, but I love it when you get history repeating in a bizarre way like this. But that indeed does end the story of Nero and the Julio-Claudians as a whole. From 44 BCE with the rise of Julius Caesar as dictator for life, and quick assassination thereafter, to 68 CE with Nero's mystery-laden death. 112 years. That's the time Rome existed under the power of the Julio-Claudians. Some years for the better, and some for the much, much worse. I think it's only fair here at the end for me to do a short retrospective view on the Julio-Claudian dynasty. I might give some further thoughts later in a mid-break special, but I'll sort through some stuff here now. This story started all the way back in March of 2021, and now here we are in September of 2024. I've spent a long time with the Julio-Claudians, for better or worse. It was really weird for me to dive into this with my preconceived notions of each emperor based on historical fact and fiction I had already consumed up until that point. Like, yeah, obviously Augustus was great and Caligula is a weird psycho. Little did I expect that through all of my personal research that I would come out feeling oddly sympathetic to the emperors. But I will immediately add the massive caveat that I don't think you should idolize any of the Julio-Claudians, they were all massive war criminals among other things. Julius Caesar, not an emperor, and I will always stand by that truth, was just a bad person. Like, if that's what I came out of this with, it's that he is one of my most hated historical figures now. Augustus was so interesting to research because the story begins with him as barely an adult and going on to become one of the greatest and longest reigning figures in Roman history. Even if he wasn't a perfect human, you at least have to acknowledge the fact that he took a broken ship that was almost sunk, pulled it up, did some pretty risky remodeling, and managed to get it sailing again. There's a reason he had the most episodes over him. Then there's Tiberius. While everyone has always liked to characterize him as the grumpy old man who turned into a sadistic pervert, I was surprised that I came out thinking, geez, this guy just never wanted to be a ruler and I feel bad for him. Like, yeah, he made some poor judgments after his semi-retirement, but if you consider that all the weird stuff about him was probably political propaganda, then yeah, he was just some middle-aged man who really hated his job. That brings us to Caligula, or as I've come to rather call him, Gaius Germanicus. I think the fact that I don't call him Caligula already says enough. I still stand by my theory that of course he would end up that way, considering 1. His entire family lineage and upbringing, and 2. He was almost certainly mentally ill. This brings me to a fact I actually came across when researching Tiberius. There is a growing theory that some, if not all, of the Julio-Claudian emperors lived with what we would call in the modern times bipolar disorder. This would account for the different mood shifts we saw in the way they ruled, especially people like Gaius and Claudius who were said to have extreme behavior pattern changes seemingly at random. That's BPD, baby. On top of that, Julius Caesar suffered from epilepsy, and it's thought that maybe this brain disease also continued down the rest of the Julii family tree. Does this excuse all of Gaius's misdeeds? Of course not. but he probably wasn't the maniac popular history tries to make him out to be. And then there's Claudius. I think he kinda is the only one I didn't get a perspective change with. He was just there and that was perfectly okay. Maybe he was a bit worse on a personal level than I had previously thought, but I never assumed he was a great ruler to begin with. I think it's perfectly fine to refer to him as I did in his episode. Claudius the Okay. And then obviously we end with Nero. Nero is so interesting. Like, obviously I don't actually admire him, but I do genuinely think he is one of the most fascinating historical figures to ever exist. Like Tiberius, at least after a while, he didn't even really want to be emperor anymore. But I think, like Gaius, he gets a massively bad rep solely due to people who hated him writing after he died, and those writings being our primary historical sources. Like, he almost certainly was not behind the Great Fire. He was just as ready to flaunt his wealth as his two predecessors. He was a theater kid and a jock at the same time. And we technically don't know how he died. Heck, we don't really know how any of them died except for Gaius. So, in the end, the Julio-Claudian dynasty was a mess. But I had a blast researching them, and I hope you had a fun time listening to their saga. Technically, this is the end of the story, but I do plan on returning to Rome soon to talk about what happened after Nero's death, because that is an excellent epilogue that is equally as wild as the rest. But for now, that's it for this week's episode of Royally Screwed. I hope you enjoyed the journey. Be sure to subscribe to the show and tell a friend all about it. Next time, it's another edition of Were They Great? This time around, we're going to medieval Britain to talk about a king who fought back against the Vikings and aspired to coalesce the smaller kingdoms of Anglo-Saxons into one united land, England. It's the story of Alfred the Great. I hope you'll join me then for another topsy-turvy look into history's most interesting rulers.